You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 17th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, friends.
Steve, why am I getting deja vu here, Steve?
Yeah, right. I know, it's the second episode that we're recording on January 17th because I'm in Hawaii this week, so we had to pre-record an episode.
Yeah, how's the weather, Steve?
Not there yet, but I know it's supposed to be awesome.
Predict.
So, Steve, you're warm on the beach, and I'm freezing cold in the Netherlands, technically, right now.
Yeah, right.
Technically. So, Steve, I've been to Hawaii several times. Several? Yes.
Me too.
Yeah, I love Hawaii.
Me too.
I would go at any chance. This was back when I didn't have kids and everything, but I absolutely love it. I've been to several of the islands and just can't believe you're so freaking lucky you're going. Like, I would go with you if I could drop everything. I'd go in a heartbeat.
Are you saying you would trade in your kids to go, Jay? Is that what I'm hearing?
I don't think he said that.
Yeah. I've been there once before. It was awesome. But this time, I will be there with the biggest lens I've ever had. So I'm very excited.
Oh, my gosh. Look out. Hawaii.
Oh, okay. Baby.
Here comes Steve.
Well, guys, since this episode is airing on Sunday, what's the date technically today that we're airing? Saturday.
Saturday.
What?
The 27th.
Wow. Obviously, we don't know what happened in the last week, but one thing that I can tell you is that Ed Yong, the science writer, beloved science writer, prolific science writer, now he's working with The Atlantic. He wrote the wonderful book, I Contain Multitudes, and I trust his opinion quite a bit. He's a very good journalist. He wrote an article that says Blue Planet 2 is the greatest nature series of all time, and Blue Planet 2 will be available in the U.S. by the time this episode airs.
Oh, wow.
Can't wait to watch
it. Oh, my gosh. Must see.
Yeah, apparently it came out last year in the U.K., and it's only just now coming out on BBC America, so everybody will be able to enjoy it. And just he really sings its praises in this article. He says it's stunning that they – here it is in the little tag. 17 years after the original Blue Planet, the BBC Natural History Unit has perfected the art of the blockbuster documentary. Awesome.
Wow.
I know. I'm
so
excited.
Did they do it in 4K?
I don't know.
Good question.
It doesn't say in here if they did.
Oh, they must have.
And also remember, David Attenborough.
That screams for 4K.
David Attenborough always did the UK versions, but sometimes, like, what's the other one? There's Blue Planet and then Planet Earth. They're narrated by Americans on the American side.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be interested to see how they do it.
Those are both awesome series too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. I'm excited. Oh, it looks stunning.
All right. Kara, give us a what's the word.
The word this week was recommended by Mandy McChesney from Vancouver, and it's such a good one. Thank you so much, Mandy, and keep your emails coming. I know we don't have a special one set up for what's the word, but just send them to info@ because they're really, really helpful. The word this week is altricial. Altricial. That's altricial. Anybody have an idea?
It's related to altruism, probably, indirectly.
You'd think so. I'll tell you what. I can tell you what its antonym is, and it might give it away a little more. It's antonism. Jesus, I got to add that to the list now. Its antonym is precocial. Mm-hmm. Precocial. Any idea what that means?
Precocious?
As in precocious.
I know what they are,
yeah.
They deal with birds. This precocious is a medical term, like precocious puberty.
Exactly. And you know what they are, just like you said, Steve, because these are ornithology terms, but they also apply to mammals. So an altricial species gives birth or hatches young that aren't fully developed yet. They're usually not ambulatory. They don't have developed coats or feathers. They need their parents to feed them. And sometimes they can't even open their eyes. So lots of birds are altricial birds. So are cats. So are dogs. You know how when people have dogs up or cats up and they mention that they're up for adoption, they have to wait until they're a certain age before they're not gross looking. Like eventually they get cute.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see what you mean.
At the very beginning, they look pretty gross. And also people are altricial. We are worthless when we're first born. We can't do anything for ourselves.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but so the opposite end of the spectrum there are precocial species like ducks and turkeys. So those are bird species that are precocial, and deer. Actually, a lot of ungulates are precocial because they need to be able to run away from predators right as soon as they're born. Ducklings, for example, they have down. They don't have full feathers, but they can feed themselves right after birth. They don't have to wait for like mama bird, you know, to fly to the nest like a lot of birds do and to like feed them beak to beak. So of course, I think that that just goes to show that these distinctions aren't always clear, as most things aren't in science.
Yeah.
There are lots of shades in between. These are general distinctions, but they're on a spectrum. And like you mentioned, Steve, you'll hear these words a lot in ornithology, but they're useful for other other animals, especially mammals. To break it down just a little bit, the root of altricial is the Latin alere. I think that would be alere, A-L-E-R-E. That literally translates to, or directly translates to nourish. And precocial comes from the Latin precox. The plural of that would be precoces, and that means to mature before its time. You can further break that one down into roots that mean before and to ripen or to cook. So it's like before it is ripened, it's mature before its time. It's precocial, or like you said, Steve, precocious, because we're used to hearing the word precocious in regards to like a really smart kid. But of course, precocious puberty is when you go through puberty early. There are other medical uses of that word as well. It's cool. But we don't hear altricial a lot. Like we almost
have. Yeah, that's not one you're going to hear a lot. Yeah,
yeah, we didn't adapt that word to the same way that we did with precocious. So it's interesting to me that maybe we should start doing that. Like altricious, like someone that's altricious is kind of like a troglodyte or something like that. They're just not well developed yet.
Yeah, altricious.
Cool. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you could use that. It's a perfectly cromulent word. You could use that.
I think so. It's very poetic.
Somebody who's helpless and poorly formed and, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Born yesterday, maybe. That. Their eyes aren't open to the world. That could be a synonym for that.
Yeah. There you go. I'll find a way to use that in everyday speech. Altricious.
I like it. Yeah, it's cool.
All right. Bob, you're going to give us a quick update on what was cool at the Consumer Electronics Show this year.
Ooh.
Yeah, another CES or Consumer Electronics Show has come and gone. Another one that I did not attend in Vegas. So what are some of the highlights that we may see as real products this year or more likely never? the show happens in Vegas every year. About 4,000 companies are represented. It's a huge number, and regular Joes cannot go. You need to be in the industry one way or the other. But in the past, they have debuted lots of amazing things like satellite radio, 3D printers, and even the VCR way back in 1970. Those were big debuts, obviously, even if they weren't fully appreciated at the time. But, you know, so there may not be much in the way of brand new tech debuts this time, at least to match the level of some of those big debuts of times gone by. But there was a lot of interesting cross-fertilization of technology, and it was pretty big this year. For example, Amazon's Alexa and Google Home are very popular. They're already, I think, in 16% of U.S. homes, I believe. Stephen Jay, you guys have Alexa, don't you?
I have Alexa.
Yeah. They're always saying how cool it is. So spreading that voice interface to other devices is real big right now. So if you were at CES, which I wasn't, did I mention that? You would have seen signs all over that said, works with Amazon Alexa, works with OK Google. They were all over the place. They're incorporating them in like light switches, TVs, washers, door locks, cars, you name it. All have some level of voice controls. Samsung and LG and a few others actually showcased model living rooms and kitchens, all with devices and appliances that could be as frustrating as Siri to deal with verbally. I dislike Siri tremendously at this point.
I'm with you.
So frustrating.
I'm with you.
But the thing is, it's not like she's always been this bad. It's like she like lost a couple dozen IQ points. And I'm thinking, oh, hey, my phone is a six. So it's two or three generations old. And I'm thinking, you know, Apple's kind of like dialing it down. It's like, hey, that Bob, it's time to upgrade. Really pissing me off. I'll stop venting. So this also cross-fertilizes with the mythic Internet of Things, which you may have heard of, which people are apparently avoiding in droves, at least right now. The Internet of Things will eventually allow any electronic devices, even your toaster, to be on your shared network, you know, and be able to communicate with it and with other devices. But not many people, you know, want to use some arcane app to interrogate their toaster. So, but I think they will very happily talk to their toaster verbally. Seriously, this is going to be cool. I hate that, you know, the maddening manual interface when you're searching for a specific movie. You know, you go to Netflix and you got to go through that crappy process of up, down, left, right, right, right. Then you go to Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, YouTube. It's like, you know, I would love to just say, Alexa, play Terminator 2. Or how about, hey, Google, turn on the damn heat and lock all my doors while you're at it. Just verbally, like, shout it out and it's done. That's a no-brainer. How awesome would that be? So there's that. Self-driving cars were big again this year at CES. In fact, it was a third bigger than last year. And this is just going to keep on ramping up. This is going to be huge. And it's so obvious right now. It's like even saying it. It's like, yeah, what else, Bob? Everyone knows that. Companies again were showing off their prototype self-driving cars. So one company was actually even giving people rides around town in self-driving cars. I would have done that so fast. And some of them went even beyond that, like Toyota and their e-Palette concept vehicle. Did you guys hear about this? This is the idea where essentially it's a big self-driving retail store. Right? It's a store on wheels. Yeah. So you summon it. This is the idea. You summon it with your app and it drives right to your location.
What?
And you could, and of course they're not going to have a huge supply of different things, but it's going to be like a, you know, like a huge van sized or more bigger, like a 18 wheel bus. Why not?
Yeah, so you summon it to really the alleyway big. And then you rip it off.
Oh my God.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
Or you could summon to
sabotage
your
location. Yeah.
Right. They'll deal with those issues, I'm sure. But you could also apply that they're talking about restaurants, hotels. I mean, when you have driving as a service, that whole concept, it's going to change. It has the potential to change so much. Why even own a car? Just summon it when you need it. I mean, there's just so many possibilities. I was reading a story about this. You get off your plane and you're picked up by your hotel room. Your hotel room picks you up and it's like you walk in it and it's a hotel room. It's got pretty much most of what you would need in any, very small hotel room. And then it could drive you to like some destinations, some touristy destinations, or it could drive you to the actual hotel structure where it kind of lifts you up and plugs you into the structure. And then you're like, oh yeah, add a real nice kitchen. Add a real nice kitchen to my room and a real nice living room, and you plug them, add those little modules to your little, to your room. And I mean, this is just some crazy stuff that people are talking about that could happen that's just blowing my mind. It just can go all over the place. People are getting freaked out of how much this could, the fact that driving can become completely autonomous. It's freaking people out. And there's so many possibilities. What does it mean? You know, why not have your office in your car, your bedroom in a car? If you don't have to worry about driving, you could do all sorts of stuff in the car besides drive or sit there and surf the web while your partner's driving, whatever. Lots of possibilities.
I can't do any of that in the car. Like if I try to read in the car, I get barfy.
Yeah, it gets you a little.
I feel so bad for you.
Bob, I'll tell you right now, if my hotel room picks me up at the airport, I'm going to just run screaming like that. I don't even want to see what that looks like.
I would kill for a hotel room that picks me up at the airport. That sounds like my dream.
Right.
So of course they're going to experiment with lots of new ideas, most of which are not going to pan out. Most ideas are going to tank.
Correct.
And it's just, you know, if you could predict which ones are going to take off, you'll be a millionaire, right? Just figure out which idea is really going to work and resonate and not be easily abused and, you know, is going to be
functional, kind of like augmented reality. It's coming. It's no avoiding it. It's going to happen. Not sure what everyone's going to do with it precisely now, but people are going to use it in one way or the other, and it's going to change a lot of shit.
So, apparently there was a lot of AR at CES.
Yeah, but I'm going to talk about something that's related to more of maybe VR than AR. But and I think, Jay, I think you mentioned this, the Tesla suit.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, a Tesla suit.
Yeah, I was reading about it.
I got this. First off, imagine a black, almost full body, you know, pretty much all your skin is covered, except maybe your face. and it's black and it's kind of cool looking. It's kind of cool.
It's cool looking.
I would kind of wear that. Google that now. So full body, full touch, and it works by zapping your nerves. All right. I know that sounds kind of scary, but, It's supposed to provide the sensation of anything from a soft stroke, not a cardiac stroke, but you know, a stroke or a brain stroke, but from a soft touch to a hard impact. I didn't understand this though. They said, but the hard impact we've specifically limited to the own wearer's strength, not to damage any tissue or anything, to keep it safe. Sure. An impact is not going to be really, really hard because, you know, people are going to, will start dying. So of course that'll be kind of, you'll feel it, but it's going to be like not a terrible thing. I assume unless you're into that stuff. That's a whole other discussion. So they call it electro-tactile haptic feedback. And like I said, it stimulates your nerves directly with electricity. This kind of stuff seems so obvious to me. A full body haptic suit for the full, you know, full immersion. All you're missing then is what? Olfactory. Get some smells going and you're totally immersed. But get this. This stuff is developed. They already started shipping out developer kits for game designers, and they're predicting consumer models available in, wait for it, 2019. Next Whoa. Year, you might see consumer models. Sure, it's going to be expensive, but damn, eventually it'll be affordable by most people, and everyone is going to have one eventually. Come on.
You are so funny, Bob. Everyone is not going to have this. Not in a million years would I buy this and play video games. I can tell you though. Trust me, they're going to sell. No, I don't want to be gender discriminatory. There are plenty of female gamers and there will be women who wear this, but I can probably guarantee you that the XXL male suit will sell way more often than a woman's suit. Way more often. And it better be able to be cleaned.
And Kara.
It's washable, apparently.
For the women's suit, they'll charge twice as much for the
They will charge twice as much and they'll probably make it pink.
Come on. I'm not talking about teledildonics. That's a whole other category. But even all right, even if you don't want the full suit, I think the gloves
the
are
power
a no-brainer.
Glove, I mean, like in the '80s.
Come on, that's a no-brainer. The gloves would be. I mean, that's how you're really going to need to interact with the virtual environment.
We may see virtual reality parlors where you go,
where you can just rent it for a few hours,
and you play an awesome VR game in a suit with the goggles. Laser
tag. Or you watch a movie like
parlor,
that.
Right.
Yeah, it's like going to the movie.
Or other things.
Spending $5,000 or whatever to have one.
And Steve, that'll be great for like the high end stuff that you'll never be able to afford, but you'll be able to rent for an hour. Fine. And that will happen for sure. But I mean, I think it's eventually this stuff is going to get, you know, much, much. I mean, I'm talking, you know, a generation from now, 20 years from now, this is going to be standard issue in your closet. Everyone's going to have one of these.
Very,
come on.
You can't
Black
say
Mirror.
That.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
I have to ask, and the rest of you guys too. Have you heard of David Eagleman? He's a neuroscientist in Silicon Valley and at Stanford. Have you heard of his vest? It's called The Vest.
I don't think so. What's the deal?
It's very cool and in some way somewhat similar to this, but for a completely different purpose because he researches sensory substitution. So he developed this vest that has all these little motors in it that gives haptic feedback. And they also developed a really cool algorithm so that if you have your cell phone on you and you have the microphone on your cell phone on, if you are somebody who is deaf, it will take the auditory cues from the people around you that are talking and pattern them out on your vest. And they've been so good at what they call quote unquote sensory substitution that I've seen videos. It's not Braille. It's like a visual pattern representation of the actual frequency and the percussiveness. And so I've actually, really your brain just reorganizes to accept this information because it's consistent. And there are videos of these trials that they've done where there is a researcher sitting next to a whiteboard with something blocking his mouth and a deaf person sitting next to him facing the other way. And he'll say the word like umbrella, umbrella, and the guy will write umbrella on the board. It's amazing.
Whoa. Damn. So I gotta learn more about that.
It's really cool because it seems like the core technology, other than the software, but the hardware is actually somewhat similar. So I love that anytime something is developed for like immersion or gaming, there are these amazing medical applications that can come out of it. So yeah, I would definitely recommend looking into that. It's fascinating.
Excellent. Wow.
All right, Jay, tell us about space lasers.
Yeah, in recent news, NASA's using lasers like crazy. I mean, they're just trying to put them everywhere. No, this is one of my favorite all-time references to lasers is the Dr. Evil. Yeah. You know, when Dr. Evil asked for sharks with lasers attached to their frickin' heads. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah, I can't hear the word laser without going laser. You know, air quotes. So that's when lasers hit their peak for me, and I will move on. So now NASA has some interesting plans to use lasers in novel ways. So the Mars 2020 mission, I don't know if we talked about this on the show before. I don't think so. The Mars 2020 mission, for example, it has a Mars rover, and they're planning to launch, of course, in 2020. I hope they hit their date because they named, you know, the mission is named 2020. It's always risky when you do something like that. So their plan is to use an instrument called a supercam. Not the most inventive term I've heard for, but it's really not. It's a combination of a laser and a camera that can read things. So listen to this. They said that they can identify a chemical or mineral composition of its targets. And the way that they're doing it is that the target could be as small as the point of a pencil, and the laser can fire at targets. I read a couple of different things. Someone was saying over 20 feet or 7 meters, and then they were saying hundreds of feet in meters. Like, I think it could be very far away. It shoots bursts of laser light for several nanoseconds. Now, this is oddly similar to Bob's sex life. The target's surface gets vaporized, right? So a little bit of the surface material gets vaporized, and the atoms that come off of the target, and since they were recently vaporized, they're excited, so they have a lot of energy, and this allows a spectrometer to clearly see what the chemical makeup is of the target. I believe that the rover that has the laser, the ExoMars rover, can do this at a far enough distance where it doesn't have to drive up close to everything. So I think it's going to be a very useful tool to like examine things that are in a crevice or, you know, things that are far enough away where they need eyes to understand what the material is that they're looking at. That's cool. That's supposedly happening, you know, within a couple of years. I'm very excited about seeing what they discover on Mars with that rover. Number two, this isn't NASA. This is a Russian company. They have plans they're trying to develop a plan or a way to send energy to the moon using lasers. Russia's Rocket and Space Corporation and Energia, RSC Energia, their idea is that they can send electrical energy using the laser.
Whoa.
Yeah, this is a really provocative idea. Their idea is to put a transmission platform 100 to 200 kilometers above the surface of the moon in a polar orbit. And I think the polar orbit is relevant to what they think the early missions, where the early missions are going to go. And not so much that it needs to be in a polar orbit, but that they claim that with this idea that they're hatching, that in a 24-hour time span, they could have up to 12 power transfers, each one taking 5 minutes. And each one of these transfers would have, the total, I think, for a 24-hour day would be a 900 watt-hours of energy. Now, to give you some perspective, a desktop computer uses between 60 and 250 watts. I mean, I have a 1,200-watt power supply on my computer because I've got like two video cards and all that stuff. But, you know, average computers, a non-idling computer will be using about 250 watts. That's a desktop, and a laptop computer that isn't, you know, that's being used aggressively is using about 45 watts. So it's not an insignificant amount of energy. And I'm assuming that they're saying that this would be the only energy transfer. So it could be emergency backup power for a station. I could see that, which I think is a great idea. Now, of course, we're going to have a permanent base on the moon, being able to send them energy. This is a great idea. It would go a long way to making these types of missions possible. You know, of course, I am demanding a moon base. I am adamant about a moon base. And it has to be called Alpha Moon Base 1 or something like that. Please. And make it look cool. While you're at it, whoever's building this, just make it look cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right.
Aesthetics are important.
Yeah, it is. So, all right. So that's the second one. I thought that one was really cool. Mm-hmm. This third one, though, this one could be a game changer. And we've mildly talked about this previously. So another use for the laser in space is that they could use it to get rid of space debris. And I'm a big fan of getting rid of space debris. Scientists in China have theorized that a floating orbital platform around the Earth could have a laser mounted to the top of it. And the idea is that the laser could shoot like these 20 bursts per second for 2 minutes energy transfer from the laser to, say, objects that are in the 1 to 10 centimeter range. Now, these objects that are in the 1 to 10 centimeter range, let me look at my chart real quickly. There's about 17,000 17,500 or 17 over 17,000 pieces of debris or things in orbit around the Earth that are of a certain size. And they're saying here this is like larger than a baseball, say, or baseball size and up. But we also have 200 million pieces that are in the millimeter in size area. Like, and these are, you know, they're everywhere. And these are traveling extraordinarily fast, right? So one of these little pieces could easily take out a spaceship, as an example, or the space station. So what they're saying is they want to take this laser burst and they want to shoot it at these the smaller pieces and the ones that are harder to track and do one of two things. One, vaporize it itself, just get rid of it just like that if it's small enough. And if not, then have the laser hit it on an angle that will deorbit it, that will actually make it get pulled into the gravity well of the Earth and not have it be in orbit anymore, and then it would burn up in the atmosphere. Now, that's the best case scenario. But this was very interesting because it could also be worse, because it could take these objects and just make smaller objects that could still do horrible damage to spacecraft, but just make them even, you know, more difficult to track and to take care of. So they're being very cautious, which is fantastic. You know, but this piece of technology sounds like not only is it needed, but it sounds like it's very doable. You know, we just need the optics to be able to find and track and have the precision to have the laser hit those objects. But I think it's, you know, it's very doable. It would be, you know, solar powered, of course. You know, put three or four of these up there and just let them go to Freaktown for a few years and get rid of the debris that we have out there. And that'll help us prevent further debris. So lasers, guys, this is like lasers, like the technology from the idea of a laser, old, but still amazingly useful. Whoever came up with the laser, whatever scientists invented them, we still need them. We'll always probably be using lasers in some form or another. And to me, the idea of a laser as a child was just, it was borderline science fiction, how cool it was.
Hey, Jay, what does laser stand for?
Light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation.
Oh my God, so Bob.
Good job, Jay. Wow,
see,
Jay, that was fast.
See, Bob, this is why people can't tell the difference between you guys' voices. They're always complaining, which to me is hilarious because you sound so different.
I know. Bob speaks Bob is quicker at the wit with me with pieces of information like that. But I will give it to Bob. I know the answer to that question because of Bob. Like, once again.
Oh, that's
great. Did I ever tell you guys a story about I was taking a computer class in college many, many moons ago. And I love this story.
I love this story.
So the teacher is asking us, so let's talk about what a megabyte is. You know, let's talk about a bit and, you know, a megabit. Let's talk about, you know, so we get up the ladder and I knew it all the way up to yottabyte.
Nice.
And in my notes, and the teacher was blown away that I had any, because nobody knew this stuff back then. Nobody knew even what terabyte was. The only thing that people knew were, you know, gigabytes was like, you know, a new term back then.
Yeah.
I don't even think anything existed like that. Like he, and I wrote in my notes, thanks, Bob, with an exclamation point, to remind me to go back home to thank my brother for completely and utterly filling my head full of something that finally paid off. Right, Bob? It finally paid
that
off.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bob. All right, Kara, tell us about this new rainbow dinosaur that's been discovered.
Yay. I don't know if you guys
is this like a rainbow pony or,
you know, yeah, unicorn. It's a magical children's toy.
My Little Dinosaur. What is
My
it?
Little Dinosaur. Well, he was little. He was duck-sized and probably only weighed like a pound. That's so cute.
Yeah.
It's so funny because lots of times when we see these artist renderings of dinosaurs or, you know, science artist renderings, they're out of context. It's just like on a white background. And so I always think of them as being enormous. Like every time I see a dinosaur, I'm like, it's huge. Nah, this one's duck-sized. Guys, he's so cute. I hate to do this. It's like not fair because this is a podcast, but I really recommend looking up this new dinosaur. A lot of these are discovered in China. They have names that are kind of hard to say. I'm going to try it. I think it's Kaihong Juji. Theropod, 160 million years ago, older than Archaeopteryx, discovered in China, and gorgeous fossilization. Just stunning. So well preserved, in fact, that not only can you see its plumage, you can see variegation in its plumage. One of the authors in the article, Jing Zhu, is mentioned in a wonderful write around in National Geographic. saying that it's quite likely that Kai Hong lived in the forest, was a glider, kind of hung out in the trees and ate very small animals, little mammals, little lizards, and was really amazed by the feathers that were preserved. But of course, this is the cool part. It's highly likely that this dinosaur had iridescent rainbow colored feathers.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. And they As know that the, how?
Here's how they know that. And we've actually known how to do this Comic for a structure. While. Yeah, but we don't have a lot of good enough preserved specimens to do it. But we can actually look at the melanocytes when they are.
Melanosomes.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. The melanosomes. Oh. The sites are the cells themselves. The somes yeah. are the. The melanosomes yeah. produce the color or hold the color. Melanocytes produce the color.
Yeah, they hold the color, the melanosomes. By looking at the melanosomes, you could tell what color they were.
Yes.
They
okay.
have, they're like red ones have different shapes than blue ones. And in yes. this case, they were shaped like the ones that we find on the iridescent feathers of hummingbirds.
Hummingbirds. Yeah. And so we're used to looking at like kind of the throat and the belly area of a hummingbird. They have these really gorgeous, like prismatic metallic feathers. And it looks like even this long ago, the melanosomes are similar. And so, I mean, there's no way we could know for sure, but it's quite likely that they look like that. And we have other evidence in 2012. There was a microraptor that scientists discovered probably was like bluish, like dark bluish, shiny, sort of like some crows, like that deep bluish black. I don't know if you guys remember when it was big news when Archaeopteryx was looked at in that way. And it's highly likely that Archaeopteryx was black. And, you know, old renderings didn't look like that. And of course, there's this beautiful, article written about a dinosaur called Anchiornis, which is another feathered dinosaur, where it was the first ever full true color, full body rendering. And it looks like a fancy chicken. It's like black and white and has this cool kind of red thing on its head. So it's so crazy. I mean, I look at birds. And I go, look at that dinosaur. And especially when you look at really intense birds, right? African greys are so dinosaurian. Gosh, cassowaries are so dinosaurian. And mostly I think it's because they're so large and they just have this really, I don't know. You look at them and they just feel ancient. But now it's like we look at chickens and they're dinosaurian. We look at ducks and we know that they weren't just big. They were all sizes. The feathers were useful. This one's interesting because it probably was like a bit flighty. Like it could probably glide from tree to tree. The tail of it, Steve, isn't the tail fascinating? Because it fans out. And they said it might have been used kind of as a display because its neck feathers, I mean, this is speculation, but its neck feathers were so stunning. If it popped its tail up behind because it's big and fan-like, it could have made a dark background kind of like birds of paradise do today.
Uh-huh. Right.
And there's evidence that all of these kind of feathers and feather-like filaments and things were not first used for flight and weren't even capable of flight at first, but were actually used for display first and eventually evolved into flight capability.
Sure.
Display him. Or temperature regulation.
Yeah.
Catching small prey, whatever. But this one, you know, may have glided, you know. It is amazing, you know, how diverse the feathered dinosaur clade was, you know, that really were just – so many different species in what is now China, really just amazing. We probably still have just seen the tip of the iceberg of this diversity, you know, this explosion that happened at that time, you know, 150, 60, 70 million years ago. And just one branch led to birds. And again, this is such stunning confirmation of evolutionary theory. I mean, there's no other way to interpret this. But, you know, back in Darwin's day, we had nothing, right? We had birds and mammals and reptiles, and nobody knew what birds evolved from. And evolution, of course, required that there would be a connection between the major groups because they had to, you know, evolve from a common ancestor. And now we have this entirely, we filled in all of this space, this morphological space between birds and reptiles, and specifically dinosaurs, and we're filling it in more and more, and showing all the adaptive radiation of the different, you know, kinds. And it also is the other lesson to take from this is get away from any linear notion of like evolving two birds. They were just evolving in every direction, and we're just biased by the one group of dinosaurs that survived to modern times, the birds. You know, they weren't evolving towards birds though; they just were radiating all over the place.
And it's awesome how, you know, how the theory could have been utterly tanked at any point since then. And something could just easily have completely overturned it and said, well, we are way wrong. But every discovery just confirms at every level, no matter how you look at it, you know, from 40,000 feet or from 1 micron away, it all works.
The puzzle pieces fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
We know that you listen to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe because you are lifelong learners, and a really great way to continue your education is to get The Great Courses Plus. Guys, it's awesome. You can watch these different courses. There's so many of them on your laptop, on your TV, on your desktop, on your smartphone. And now with The Great Courses Plus app, you can even listen to these lectures like a podcast.
Guys, this week we recommend you take a look at What Einstein Got Wrong. This was created by Dan Hooper. We've had Dan on the show.
Dan Hooper talks about Einstein's scientific career, the way he revolutionized the way we think about the universe and transformed our conceptions of space and time, gravity, light, energy, and matter. But apparently he was human, he claims. This course looks at how some of his philosophical prejudices and flawed thinking led him to conclusions that turn out to be false. Wait a second. That's not true. Wait, there's a cosmological concept. He got that wrong. Quantum theory, yeah, he was kind of, all right, yeah, so maybe he does have some good stuff to stay here.
As an SGU listener, you'll get a free trial copy to enjoy it all, but you need to go to our special URL. Start the free trial today. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, so Jay, you're going to take the week off for Who's That Noisy because we're recording on the same day, so you'll get us caught up on the next show.
You got it.
We do have one email for this week. This one comes from Dr. David Grinter, who says he's a clinical psychologist, and he writes, "Hey guys, a couple of days ago, the Guardian newspaper published a piece by Johann Harry, which hyperbolically asked, 'Is everything you think you know about depression wrong?' For me, this piece raises one or two important issues with how we understand and treat mental ill health. However, it's a piece that is riddled with science denial tropes and fallacies of thinking." Harry also cites a dubious source of Irving Kirsch. There was a short response piece the following day, which highlights some of the issues. Harry's admitted fraudulent journalism being a big one, but doesn't go into a deep dive on the issues and is a little lenient in places. He goes on to talk more about it, but basically he's talking about this article by Johann Harry that is pretty, in my opinion, when I read it, and I did blog about it on Neurologica because I just had to, but it's pretty straightforward mental illness denial kind of tropes, and some pretty shocking intellectual failure, I think, on his part. So let me go through what I think is the biggest howler in this article. So, you know, Harry is creating this narrative that is a complete fiction. His narrative is that psychiatrists and the psychiatric profession has this simplistic notion that depression is entirely due to a chemical imbalance. And they deny the environmental, psychological causes of depression. So when they created the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, they basically just said, if you have these depressive symptoms to this degree for this amount of time, you have depression. And then in Harry's narrative, in his sort of cartoon version of reality, then clinicians were like, hey, but what about people who just lost somebody, who are grieving a lost loved one? So they created a grief exception in the DSM. So, okay, well, if somebody just died, then for 6 months, you won't, it doesn't count, right? If you're depressed for 6 months, that's just normal grief. It won't count as the diagnosis of depression. But then over the years, in each iteration of the DSM, they whittled away the duration and until finally they got rid of it entirely. And the reason why they did this was because it torpedoes their entire premise of mental illness, because if depression due to grief has a psychological cause and not a biological cause, then why can't everything have a psychological cause? And maybe there are no biological causes for any of the things in the DSM. And so they just had to pretend it didn't exist. So they got rid of the grief exception in the DSM-5.
Yeah. Again, this is still iteration. This dude's argument.
This is his narrative. This is his,
yes.
Which is a completely yeah. fake, you know, narrative of what happened.
Yeah, it's a straw man from the beginning, because that's not what any psychiatrist thinks.
Exactly. Yeah, so anybody who's, I think, familiar with mental health practice sees this as a complete straw man. But the thing that really is the howler is his complete misrepresentation of the DSM. So it is true that the DSM removed the grief exception from the criteria, the jot listed criteria for major depression. But what they did was at the end of that. So if you look up DSM-5 and you look up depression at the, it contains a note. And let me just read it entirely, because it is so 180 degrees opposite from Harry's cartoon that he was creating in his article. It says, this is the DSM now, the DSM-5. Note, responses to a significant loss, e.g. bereavement, financial ruin, losses from a natural disaster, a serious medical illness or disability, may include the feelings of intense sadness, rumination about the loss, insomnia, poor appetite, and weight loss noted in criterion A, which may resemble a depressive episode. Although such symptoms may be understandable or considered appropriate to the loss, the presence of a major depressive episode in addition to the normal response to a significant loss should also be carefully considered. This decision inevitably requires the exercise of clinical judgment based on the individual's history and the cultural norms for the expression of distress in the context of loss. That's in the DSM. Wow, is that a different, completely different reality than the cartoon that's like mental illness deniers and Harry's article creates of these simplistic psychiatrists who are denying the complexity of depression. Right there in the DSM, it says, hey, there's real life cause, not just the loss of a person, but the financial or natural disaster or medical illness. And you have to take this into consideration. And they may have one or both, you know, or the other. And you have to put this in the context of cultural norms and how it's expressed, you know, in this individual and their history, and use your clinical judgment. Right. That's the reality.
Yeah.
It's messy.
He's ignoring.
It's complicated.
Yeah. So many things. He's ignoring the politics that went into how the DSM has been written and how every revision has been written from all the different people coming from different theoretical orientations and theoretical backgrounds with mental illness. He's ignoring the clinical judgment. It's like he wrote this article as if psychiatrists get their and psychologists get their licenses online. Like, as if they don't go to medical school or like they don't go through a 7-year training program to become a licensed therapist and work with patients for thousands of hours to be able to develop clinical judgment. It's insulting, honestly.
Yeah, it's very insulting.
The profession.
And then he launches into this false dichotomy where he's like saying, actually, people are depressed because we have unmet needs. Society isn't meeting our needs. We are isolated. And this is how he concludes. If you are depressed and anxious, you are not a machine with malfunctioning parts. You are a human being with unmet needs. The only real way out of our epidemic of despair is for all of us together to begin to meet those human needs for deep connection to the things that really matter in life. So I'm not saying that that's not true, but it's such a false dichotomy.
Uh-huh.
It's like, actually, we are freaking machines with malfunctioning parts, and we also are psychological beings who have needs which may be unmet, and we have stressors, and life can suck sometimes. And you know, there's a complex interaction between biology, neurology, environment, culture, situation. Our brains are an organ that evolved to interact with the outside world in real time with our
culture.
And
our brains are plastic.
Plastic, exactly. But they can also malfunction. That doesn't mean that they're not also machines that can malfunction. And so psychiatrists have to tease apart, okay, first of all, and this is how psychiatry works, by the way, there are tiers, right? There's a hierarchy of diagnoses. And the first level is, okay, first let me make sure there's nothing biological going on, right? This person doesn't have hypothyroidism or something that's, you know, it's purely bio. They don't have a brain tumor, right? So let's first rule those things out. It's like, okay, good. So there's nothing biological going on here. Now let's try to tease apart how much is this person's life situation? Do they have a reason to be depressed? Is it their, what's their personality? There's a personality level here.
What's their cultural history?
Yeah. And then if that doesn't really explain it, then you might think, okay, maybe there's a neurological cause here that's in a, even though it might not be, there may not be diseased cells, maybe the brain is just not functioning within acceptable parameters. You know, there's a disorder here and it's really out of proportion to what can be explained by the life situation. And it's a disorder. It's a dysfunction. It's impairing their life. They've come into my office because they feel that their life is off the rails because of these excessive symptoms of depression or anxiety or whatever it is. So let's find a treatment, and that treatment may be therapy. But it may also be biochemical. It may also be pharmaceutical. And a good psychiatrist considers all of these things with clinical judgment in as evidence-based way as possible. And his cartoon of psychiatrist thinks it's all malfunctioning parts and you need drugs. But actually it's all this psychological stuff and we need to meet our unmet needs. That's the cartoon. His approach is the simplistic cartoon, ironically.
And he's saying that all of psychiatry and all of mental health care sees it as, oh, let's just throw pills at them. Like he has some sort of hyper insane idea of like, remember there's a scenario in there where he's like, you give birth to a stillborn child at 12 and at 12:05, they're giving you Prozac or I can't remember how we put it in. You're like, are you out of your mind? So
yeah, it's ridiculous.
And the thing is, there's a few things that he's really leaving out that are beautiful and nuanced and fascinating about mental illness. For one, mental illness by definition, you know, we talk about it as a disease model sometimes because I think that's a way to try and remove stigma around it. But like you mentioned recently, Evan, I can't remember if in the last episode or this one, words matter and words have meaning. And technically, many types of mental illness that are described in the DSM are syndromes. They are not diseases.
Right, meaning disorders, that, not
yeah,
diseases.
There's a collection of symptoms and we have to work to try and alleviate or reduce those symptoms. And also, there's not like one person's depression is simply because they don't have enough dopamine. And this other person's depression is simply because they lost their job and haven't been able to get over it. Like it's a diathesis stress model. It's all of those things all the time. Yeah. You cannot tease nature and nurture apart because there's a feedback loop there. So for me, I can take an antidepressant every day. I take citalopram. There's a story he tells in his article about how people take an antidepressant and then they, you know, 6 months later, it doesn't work anymore. And that happens to some people. I've been on the same antidepressant and the same dose for years. And my depression symptoms are well managed and well controlled. For some people, it's not that simple because their depression is different than my depression.
Yeah. You have to individualize it and there's some trial and error that's going to be involved. But he then, in effect, I feel he stigmatizes treating mental illness with the full range of options that we have, including medication. And, that is very harmful. And also, I can't tell you, whenever I write about this or we talk about this, we get so many emails from people like, oh, thank God you said that because I have depression or anxiety or whatever. My life sucks. And if I'm not taking medication, and it's great when I'm on medication, and I just hate people who don't know what they're talking about, stigmatizing my medical care that I need, to really function well. And it's completely inappropriate and it's unfair. And it could also, I see lots of patients where they're scared away from medication, not for any rational or cautious reason, but because of this unfair stigma that's attached to it.
I didn't start taking meds until I was in my late 20s because I always thought, I've been depressed my whole life and my life is shitty, but like, I guess that's just what people have to deal with. And I'm not actually crazy. I don't actually need meds. Yeah. And then I realized like, no, I'm allowed to live a healthy life and enjoy myself like everybody else. And this is a means for me, but it's different for different people. Some people don't respond well to meds. Some people talk therapy is more important. I personally recommend both. I think both are usually helpful if the person responds well to both.
It's got to be individualized.
It's got to be individualized. I think that we shouldn't be stigmatizing psychiatry the same way we shouldn't be stigmatizing psychology. And yes, there is some kernel of truth. That's what pseudoscience is. There's a kernel of truth to the fact that there are existential underlying issues within society that can contribute to depression, but mm-hmm. all of those things contribute. And I think what bugs me about the stigmatization, just like this article does, and the victimization, kind of the victim blaming of individuals who struggle yeah. with mental illness. What really bugs me is that it not only makes people feel like they are abnormal and stigmatized, but it also is like, I don't know, just another repackaging of the bullshit secret power of positive thinking movement.
Yeah.
This idea that you can will yourself out of it if you just reframe your life, if you just think differently about things, and it's blaming the victim in the grossest way possible.
It is. Yeah. So people feel like they should be able to therapy their way out of a major depression. And yeah. I'm sorry, but some people can't. And they can't.
Or self-help their way out of it. Yeah. Right? And the thing is, there are people who can't therapy who aren't even helped by therapy or medication. There are some people who have to get ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. There are people for whom all three of those things don't work. They have treatment-resistant depression. Some of those people, their only way out is the most, you know, terrible way out. And so that's a really bummer thing about this. We make light of something that actually is a very onerous healthcare problem and an onerous personal problem for many people. It's the most common. Depression is massively common and it's responsible for the most kind of lost work hours of the mental illnesses, and it can be a terminal disease. So I think that trying to tell people if they just think more positively that they're going to get better is really irresponsible. And also, he's not a damn shrink.
So, and the other thing, I mean, I'm offended primarily just as a skeptic, as an intellectual, at his characterization of psychiatry and the DSM when it literally took me 5 seconds to find that passage in the DSM-5 that blows his entire straw man thesis out of the water. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, that's just intellectual laziness and dishonesty. That's epic. But another thing is, so a lot of people will bring up, well, what about the pharmaceutical industry and how they promote their drugs, et cetera? And yes, there's a lot to criticize about how the pharmaceutical industry conducts itself, tries to hide data it doesn't like, tries to promote its drugs. But don't equate that with the profession. Don't equate mm-hmm. that with psychiatrists, because we are critical of it too. Mm-hmm. That's why we favor the proper regulation to keep the pharmaceutical industry from, you know, doing what corporations do, as, you know, prioritizing profits above everything else. And so, but that doesn't mean that mental illness is bunk or that you should never use pharmaceuticals to treat mental illness. It just means that we need to regulate the pharmaceutical industry better and make sure they don't abuse, you know, their position.
It's just really, really frustrating when people throw the baby out with the bathwater this way. I think it's no different than people being anti-GMO because they're not comfortable with some of the corporate practices of companies like Monsanto. Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Oh, it's frustrating.
Don't confuse. And The last point that I wanted to make was that it's just, again, as a clinician, it's offensive too, because any respectable clinician knows that patients will complain of a lot of things that are normal, and we just tell them, don't worry about that. It's normal. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I have every day, pretty much, I have patients give me some complaint about something, and I just tell them, yeah, okay, that's within the range of normal. Don't worry about it. Don't do any testing for it. Don't treat it. Just don't worry about it. They're just, you know what I mean?
And like what, Steve?
Oh, like whatever. Well, my eyelid twitch. That's a common one. My eyelid's been twitching a lot. Yeah, they do that. That's completely benign. Yeah. Oh, that's not a sign of anything that you need to be concerned about. Just don't worry about it. Just to give one example.
Or like I have visual migraines. That's not normal, but it doesn't mean I'm dying of a brain tumor.
Yeah, well, that is a thing, though. That's
it's
like
a thing.
Mental,
you're right. It's
like a
thing.
A mental illness, but the twitching eyelid is nothing. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, but yeah, so just, yeah, we do that. We tell, you know, it's not like we medicalize every little everyday symptom. You know, that's, again, part of the clinical judgment is knowing. And I was told this when I was a student, and I tell, you know, many students this too in the right context, that in order to know what's abnormal, first you have to know what's normal, right? You have to appreciate the full range of human variation of what's normal. And that gives you more judgment to realize when something is actually pathological or disordered or basically abnormal. That is especially true in psychiatry because mood, thought, and behavior is so variable. And so, context dependent and culture dependent, et cetera. That's why it's really hard to define mental illness, because what's normal, what's healthy is so variable. you have to develop some really practical criteria for how to decide, like, who, you know, reasonably should be treated with whatever.
And it's evolved a lot. Like, go it read has. The DSM-1 and now read
oh
the
my
DSM-5.
God. Yeah. So very, very different. All right, let's move on. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Lisa.
Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand, and this is actually a respectable company. This company goes out of its way to make good and give back, and they make a very good mattress.
Yeah, Jay, for every 10 mattresses that they sell, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program, and then they also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes, which is great.
Yeah, but then they slap one harbor seal, too, just to balance
it out. Oh, poor seal.
Yeah, but don't forget, guys, there are three premium foam layers, including a 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, a 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and of course, a 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure.
And now they've got an expanded product offering, including the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. So guys, what are you waiting for? Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. It's available in the US, the UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho and also Virginia Beach and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide.
So get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So we have a fun little interview that we did with Richard Saunders when we were at SciCon. So let's go to that interview now. Well, we're sitting here now at SciCon 2017 with our good friend Richard Saunders. Richard, how you doing, man?
Hi, Steve. Nice to be back in Las Vegas.
That's right. Yeah, we haven't been here for actually a few
Two years since the last TAM.
Yeah.
That's right. I really missed it. I've been coming to Las Vegas every year for TAM since 2008, and suddenly not to come to Las Vegas one year was a bit jarring, actually, because I really enjoy my 4 or 5 days in Vegas. And I'm seeing you guys for a start. But seeing the gang, as we say, and experience the madness, which is Las Vegas.
Yeah. It's funny to think that TAM doesn't exist anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It was a big
That's
part
the
of
the amazing
our lives.
Meeting for those who may not know. Yeah, it was the official conference of the James Randi Education Foundation. They decided just they didn't want to do conferences anymore. They're doing other stuff. So, yeah, but this is SciCon, which is deliberately having it in Vegas to sort of fill the gap.
It's only just started today, really. But I'm seeing a lot of the same people I would normally see at TAM anyway, which is really great. And the speakers are lined up. So it's, I don't want to call it another TAM. It's its own thing, but it's great. It's very similar, I guess.
So Richard, you're basically, I like to think of you as the Stephen Novella of Australia, if I might, at least in the very limited sense that you are the producer of a very long-standing, your preeminent skeptic podcast, The Skeptic Zone. Mm. This is your 9th year. Right.
Yeah.
One more year and you'll hit 10 years.
Yeah, my goodness me. I'm up to show number 470 something at the moment.
That's so cute.
And you like that?
Yeah. Something I remember the 400s.
You remember that?
Yeah.
And next year at some stage or other I could calculate it. I don't know whether to celebrate the 500th show or the 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Because
there's
slightly you do that you do both?
You did both.
Yeah, okay.
Because you're right, they're different.
They're slightly different because of the 52-week
unless just, you know, skip the weeks in order to make it work
you
out.
You can fudge things a little bit. Yeah. I suspect what I'll do is I'll decide that the 500 is the bigger thing. Or if I can make it to Dragon Con, which I won't rule out because I haven't been there for years. But that's where the very first show was kicked off.
Oh, really? I think I saw that show.
You probably did. You might have. 2008 at Dragon Con, we had our very first Skeptic Zone segment. Mm-hmm.
Did you wear a boa, a pink boa?
Yes,
I
might have.
I saw that.
Oh,
I was
yeah,
at
we
that
saw
show.
That. We were there. Yeah.
How about that? How about that? I don't think we really knew each other then. It's hard to tell.
I don't remember.
I think we did.
Not as close
as we are.
Yeah,
now.
Not like now.
Yeah,
but I thought I knew pretty much everyone. It was you, Rachy.
No, it
Joe,
makes sense.
Right?
It makes sense because we would have met at TAM earlier that year anyway.
Before,
anyway, but regardless.
Right.
So I don't know. It's still down the track, and I'm still every week like you do, Steve, producing a show every week. Yeah.
How's that going?
Well, it's great. I mean, the listeners, just in the last while, the listenership has gone up, which is very pleasing when that happens. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, I just love it because I'm getting interviews from reporters from around mm-hmm. the world. Aran Segev, who you met just recently,
yep.
is one of my reporters. He's also the president of the Australian Skeptics. He sent me interviews from his travels in the United States and other countries. And I do a lot of my own interviews over Skype and whatever. Mm-hmm. But some weeks, you know, and it's no secret, some weeks it's just a lot of hard work just to mm-hmm. get the show out on time so people can listen to it. And it's never really shorter than 45 minutes, and sometimes it's just over an hour. But that's a lot of production.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah. what I hear, yeah.
I'll tell you all about it, Steve.
Yeah, right.
You can come to my workshop, How to Produce a Podcast.
Well, let me ask the two of you guys, though. You know, you sit in a seat that yeah. not many people do, right? So you have a show that you are largely responsible for. You know, yeah. You're not 100% responsible for creating all the content, but you are 100% responsible as the editor. And as, you know, not just the editor as an editorial policy, but editor as in you are editing the post-production.
There's technical post-production.
Yeah, post-production. Yeah.
And then there's the
editorial.
Yeah,
and so, I guess we're both, right?
We're both.
Yeah. So as podcasters in general, because I think there's a few interesting questions that I want to ask you guys. As podcasters in general, do you find it difficult to be on this treadmill that you have to run pretty much every week?
I don't know if difficult is the right word. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's very difficult because I've got things I have to get together in the last hours before the show goes to air, and that can be difficult. Mm-hmm. But the mechanics of it aren't difficult. After all these years, I know the mechanics of it very well. Yeah. Sometimes I have difficult decisions to make, what to play and what not to play.
Yeah. That so as an editor, you know, in charge of what makes it onto the show, yeah. you have to be, there's a lot of consideration.
There's a lot of consideration. With me, I fail sometimes. I don't want it to be too political. It's a PG show, mm-hmm. and I'm always mindful of that.
Oh, that's bullshit.
That's right. That's what I said. because that's my upbringing was yeah. from a very religious man, my dad. Yeah. And I have no qualms with that. I mean, I'm PG in mixed company and when I'm on my public persona, but in private, as you guys know, I'm not exactly PG.
But there's a very specific reason for that too, yeah. and that is you don't want to get an explicit rating on iTunes because that might limit your audience.
That's true. Yeah. And also I get letters, emails from people, from parents who listen to their to my show when they're driving down the road with their kids,
yeah.
and I think that's great.
Yeah,
you know,
too, yeah.
and people think that I've got something against swearing and vulgarity. Well, I don't. In its context, in the right place, you know, in the right situation, I don't care. That's fine.
All right, so Richard, just for our audience's yeah. sake, give us a hearty fuck right now. Let's hear it. See, see, he's full of it. He doesn't you don't like to swear.
I don't like to swear, generally speaking, especially if it's going to be broadcast.
Yeah. It's a good. Yeah.
No, I would edit it out anyway.
Yeah.
But what's the?
Oh,
worst?
He's going to edit it out, right?
What's the? No, he'll bleep what I did. He'll bleep it so people can.
Yeah. I just said it so he can edit it. There you go.
All right. What's the worst curse in Australia? Is fuck still the top of the heap, or is there? Would do something else? You think it cuts to the bone a little bit deeper?
Something that cuts to the bone, yes.
Yes, I think I know what he's talking about. A word that's a similar C word.
Yeah.
Is the word bogan a bad word?
Ah, you know it. You know the word bogan.
I've been friends with Australians for over a decade now. Yes, I know the word.
it depends on who you talk to. And we always try to think, what's the American equivalent? I'm not sure there is. Redneck is probably the closest you'd get.
We have hillbilly, redneck.
Hillbilly, redneck, yep. that sort of thing. It can be an insult.
Yep.
You bogans wouldn't understand. Yeah. Oh, she's just a bogan.
It's derogatory.
Yeah, it's derogatory. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
All right. So getting back real quick.
Yeah.
Steve.
Yeah. So the editorial decisions are usually not difficult. And that's, you know, after 12 years, I pretty much have that down.
Yeah.
You know, it's usually we over record and then we cut it down to fit. So sometimes it's a matter of not, you know, do I want to have this on the show? But just, all right, something's got to go. It's just too long. Yep. And I got to get it down to, you know, and I've actually increased the size of the show. I used to keep it pretty much right to an hour 20. But now I'll go to an hour 30.
If you have to.
If I have to, you know.
But the original and original reasoning for that was because we wanted people to be able to burn it onto a CD.
Yeah, we actually people write us and say, you know what, I burn it onto a CD and I listen to the show that way and the CD can only hold an hour 20.
Yeah, that was
It's really difficult. That's if it's 1 second over, it would be difficult for them, so I had a hard limit there. But then I don't think that's a thing anymore, so I don't have to worry about it. So I'll go to an hour 30.
Yeah, cell phones kill that.
But if we have 2 hours of content, I got to abridge it basically down to an hour 30, more or less.
Yep.
And so that can sometimes be a little challenging because
But sometimes, though, it's not as challenging because you could take one entire chunk wholesale of someone's talk, like, say, for example, my talk about some astronomy or physics
thing.
You
always notice when I cut your thing.
You could just take it right out, and then you have that, and you can
well,
use
that goes
it
to premium
in premium content.
Yeah.
So it kind of works out.
That's a great idea because if there's whole segments, I'm like, all right, like sometimes we do a segment and it goes too long. Like we talk about a news item for 20 minutes and there's no way I could do that news item justice in 5 minutes or even 10 minutes. And so it's easier just to cut the whole thing out, leave it unabridged, and then just put the whole thing in premium content. Yeah. And that way I take 20 minutes out of the show and it frees up space for everything else.
But it's still going out.
But it's still being used. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then interviews are a great thing.
Interviews, same thing too. Like we might do a 40-50 minute interview and it can only really fit 15 minutes in the show and then the rest is premium content.
Richard, do you do that? Do you have premium content?
No, I think I've got enough on my plate just getting one show up.
It's
more work to get the, I hear you. I wouldn't rule it out in the future, but right now, to be honest, once I press the button and the show goes out, I just walk away.
That was my next question. I wanted to ask you guys. So do you feel as essentially the editors in two different ways that we described, and you're a producer of the show.
Yeah.
What kind of satisfaction do you get when you hit that button, when you click it and you upload it and it goes out into the world?
Well, the way I produce the Skeptic Zone is all the last, it's all done in the last hours before the show goes to air. I mean, most of the editing is done during the week and collecting interviews and segments. But the last 4 or 5 hours, I'm sitting in the chair, putting them all together and doing all the technical audio equalization and redoing vamping the web page. And I always wait for the last minute to do the introduction to the show and the end bit at the end. So when I press that button, it's just relief. Stand up from my desk and I know it's gone out.
Our process is we record on Wednesday night, usually. This is our standard week, unless there's something interfering with that. And then I get the files from everybody on Thursday. By Friday afternoon, I should have everyone's files. I start to put them together and do maybe some preliminary
just lining up and
editing,
cleaning up.
Like noise reduction, things like that. And then I get up at 6 o'clock Saturday morning and I edit straight until noon. And by 11 to noon, the show should be 100% uploaded, out, done, tweeted, Facebook, it's all done. Yeah. And then that is absolutely a relief because then I know I'm good, and for a couple of days, I got the rest of the weekend and I'm done doing the show. And that's just part, I just consider that to be part of my weekly work, part of my schedule, just got to do it, But the times where I feel like it's really difficult is like when we're at a conference, like I got to get the show done before I leave.
Yeah.
That's where it's like, oh God, it's on top of everything else I got to do. I got to get a show out. So, cause I'm not going to be able to do it while I'm at the conference.
Well, this is where we differ because every conference I've been to in the last 9 years, which happens to be on a weekend, I put the show out. So this conference, sometime on Saturday or Sunday, I'll be putting out this week's episode of The Skeptic Zone.
I already did it. So I did the post-production. The show's uploaded, ready to go. I literally have to just check a box and I'm done.
Yeah. Because part of the thing I'm doing is when my show goes out, part of it will be this conference.
Are you doing, for this
I'll
week?
I'll do interviews.
Yeah, you're more on the heels of what's going on.
So
we actually recorded the show that's going to play this Saturday a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago.
We recorded it at
DragonCon.
It was our
DragonCon
private
September,
show. Which is great because then we didn't have to record a show the week we're traveling to the conference. So I try to do that as well. Like we'll record an extra show at SciCon. We'll do the live show, which will go out next week, and a private show, which I'll save until some other time, probably Thanksgiving, like when it's just everyone's traveling and it's just hard to put a show together. It's, yeah. Well, we got one, and that way everyone gets a week off, you know, basically. Yeah.
I should have some, you know, I should produce a whole show that I can use in an emergency.
It's great.
I think I should. It's good to have one really in the can. Do that. Just something so if I'm indisposed or something happens.
We used one over the summer when our father passed away.
I remember,
I had an interview, a long interview that I was basically saving for emergencies, and I think that was a good way to use it.
And I'm sure the audience would understand that one week out of the year, it's not topical.
I think they're happy to get anything. No, seriously, like we put on a show 52 weeks a year. If something's happening and we manage to put anything out, they're like, I think they're, they're grateful that we took the effort, even in the midst of everything, to say, here's your content for the week.
And I guess,
really not a usual show, but it's something.
I guess, I mean, if that pre-record show looks like it might be getting stale, you could just put it out and do another one and save it for a year or something.
I've done that too. Had a couple in the cans. Like, I got to use this now, otherwise it's going to get too crusty. But then sometimes, like, we specifically record a show that's not time sensitive.
Yeah.
Like, we don't talk about news items. You know, we talk about something that should be timeless. You know, should be at least have a good year's shelf life. Yeah, before I think it's too crusty.
So let me ask you guys another question. So do you get, both of you have a catalog behind you now. And, you know, as all of us are activists, you know, we heard a call and we answered the call.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's changed our lives. It's a huge commitment. You know, we all make painful sacrifices to do this and keep it up every week. I mean, if you think about all the things, other things you could have been doing with your life. But do both of you guys feel a level of satisfaction that is really sustaining for you? Like, do you feel very positive about the work? Do you feel like it's important? You know, do you feel that it has an impact?
It's not in the front of my head 24 hours a day. If I stop to think about it, I think you're probably right. And then the satisfaction of people writing to me and to you too, I'm sure, saying thank you very much. Or more and more these days, people will write to me and say, thank you for the show you did 6 years ago. I used that interview for something.
Yeah.
Or this item you did, because they search it.
That feels good, right?
That's great.
The work you did that long ago is still relevant.
It's still relevant and being accessed and used and referenced and think, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing about being a science-based podcast. You know, our information does hold its value, I think, longer than, say, something that is just more topical and timely.
A lot of it will not simply because of new developments, but a lot of it will.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the short answer is yeah. I mean, I think it's all worth it. You know, but you have to decide what that means. You know, it's certainly, you know, we'd love to change the world, but you can't think that, like, oh, I'm going to, like, make the world a more skeptical place in very specific and concrete ways. Because the thing is, we're just trying to make the world a more skeptical place than it would be if we weren't doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
Right? You can't really say what the world would be like if the skeptical movement weren't here. I think it would be worse. I mean, I think that we play a useful role. I think that, you know, there are some ways I see that, you know, we have...
Everyone would be wearing power barrels.
Yeah, well, whatever. I think, you know, probably for me, the easiest impact for me to perceive is in the science-based medicine arena, like when, you know, we get contacted by the FDA who wants our input on homeopathy or the NIH or whatever. There have been specific things where it's like, okay, you know, we're pushing the ball forward. But I also think over the last 10 years, 12 years since we've been doing this, the world is a lot more irrational in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I think it would probably be a lot worse if we weren't doing this.
Well, the internet, you know, the knife cuts both ways. And I think that collectively the science community and the skeptic community, you know, we have a very important role to play. You know, it's not just our two podcasts, of course. I mean, there's thousands of people out there that are pushing this message and trying to educate people and trying to, you know, affect a little piece of the world here and there. But collectively, man, it would be scary, you know, from our perspective, because I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of, like, what's going on out there and how dangerous the world can be. I mean, the internet alone is just silly with paranormal bullshit.
But we're seeing tangible things here. I mean, in Australia, I don't know if you've caught up with this, that the government just released a statement saying that they're going to stop subsidizing quackery.
Yes.
With the private
very
health.
Good. Yeah, we all right. Talked about that on our Facebook page. Mm-hmm.
And this is in no small measure to the skeptical activism which is going on, you know, with people like the Friends of Science and Medicine in Australia, for example, and the Australian Skeptics probably to a smaller degree, but nevertheless. And just in the last month or so, I've picked up a regular morning segment on Sydney radio. This is Drive Radio. This is listened to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I was on there the other week, and I just rubbished homeopathy. I didn't pull any punches. I said, it's quackery. It doesn't work. It's just sugar pills. And the hosts were a bit surprised because they, like most of the population, when it comes to homeopathy, think, oh, it's little bits of
it's natural.
All the rest have heard it all before. And when I said, no, there's nothing. People are buying sugar pills and water.
They don't have any place to connect that to. I found that as well. You talk to people about it. First, they think that homeopathy is more of like,
just natural.
Yeah, it's almost like a general descriptor. No, it's very specific. You know, and you tell people about the dilution aspect of it. And, you know, by the time you get to the quote unquote medication that there's no active ingredients in there, you know, people are like, they're like, what? Like, they're what are you talking about? It's medicine. No, it's not.
And the whole, also the like, what is it? Like curing likes. Like, I mean, that's a huge magic part of it.
And I said on the radio, I said, that's homeopathy's dirty secret. They don't want you to know that it's just they're selling you bottles of nothing. But this all stems from us keeping at it year after year after year, doing podcasts or whatever activism. Yeah. We end up on something like a talk radio station, which people are listening to in their cars by the thousands. And that's great, you know?
Yeah.
That's absolutely. So it does make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful when you hit into a large audience, when you get enough people listening to you and everything. Because there is a, you know, you tell one person and they tell two people type of effect. I mean, I think it's not just the people that are listening, but then they will spread that information, hopefully, you know, on some level. That information is getting out there. Yeah.
But still, it's frustrating as hell. Come on, admit it. I mean, you still look at these polls, and the majority of Americans, you know, don't believe in evolution, or they don't know that the earth revolves around the sun type of stuff. It's like, it's so discouraging. It's hard to, sometimes, you know, that image of, you know, shoveling the, you know, emptying the ocean with a spoon.
Or fighting the ocean with a sword.
I mean, it's just frustrating. And
seeing the flat earth thing come around. And
oh my God.
Yeah, it's like, you know.
Now that surprised me.
Yeah.
That really does, and it still surprises me.
The ultimate conspiracy theory, really. Yeah. The ultimate.
It really is the ultimate. It is the biggest one I think you could ever come up with. The idea that you're going to say that pretty much all of modern science is in question. You know, hearing someone firsthand, I don't know if you've had this pleasure, horror, of hearing someone who believes in flat earth theory talk about it in person. Richard, it blows your mind that you're sitting in front of a human being that thinks that the world that we live on is a disc that's moving up at a speed that is that's where like the quote unquote gravity is coming from, and that NASA is guarding the outer ice wall perimeter of our disc that we live on.
Oh, I want to visit this outer ice world perimeter. Yeah. That sounds great.
I love the idea though, like NASA is guarding the ice wall with weapons to make sure that at that point. You'd have to think, NASA's got to be killing people that see the ice wall, because no one comes back saying, I saw the ice wall.
And how did this person know about the ice wall?
Oh, but there's so much, right? It's a cooperation between governments that we've never seen ever in history before. You know, it's scientists lying to everybody.
That's
it's
what they want you to
airline do. Pilots lying to everybody.
And even with a telescope.
And it's the scope of the conspiracy. I mean, it's like we need a new term above grand conspiracy, because it's like, it's the epic. It's the most grand conspiracy.
Grand conspiracy doesn't quite cut it anymore, does it? You need something even bigger.
All right, we'll call it the Grand Floridian conspiracy.
But I mean, look at the Earth, the moon landing conspiracy. Now, 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, it was really big, you know. I heard it a lot. You don't hear much about that anymore. There are still people who think it's still out there, but it hardly makes a blip on the radar.
I like to predict the next ones. Like, I know that the Mars missions that are going to be happening, some things are going to come out of that.
Well, they made a movie about that, right, years ago, Capricorn 1.
Yeah, that was cool.
Thinking about it, though, it would be kind of fun, though, to watch a movie. Imagine if the world really was the disc as they imagine. Imagine some weird alternate reality movie where it really was the case. It was, and you could, and they show the ring of mountains, or, and you know, the sun and the moon always above the disc. That would be kind of cool to see it actually work.
Yeah, I'd like to see it visualized in a really cool,
right? That would be
3D,
and the conspiracy would be the world is round.
Yeah,
yeah. Turn around its head.
The thing that's interesting about one of the things about the flat Earth conspiracy is that it doesn't work. You know, none of the crap that we talk about works, right? Homeopathy doesn't work, and creationism, whatever. But you're talking about just like a basic model of the Earth and
right.
what we see, and it doesn't make internal sense, not even close.
Yeah.
So like there's got to be so much cognitive dissonance going on all the time.
I mean, you could suck on your homeopath and be like, I feel better.
A little better.
Right. Yeah. So you could imagine, imagine that, but this is just like really, have you actually thought this through?
But that's,
they do have answers. I mean, you think, but that's the one
not
problem
good
here.
Ones.
But that's the one problem though. You think if I got my hands on a flat earther, I could convince them in 5 minutes.
No, you
cannot. Because they have, a lot of them have thought about a lot of these questions and they have, you know, their answers are ridiculous, they are an answer. They're not going to go, holy crap, you're right. They're not going to say that. Don't expect
that. But the psychology behind people that believe in these types of things, I mean, we've read lots of studies on it at this point, and it really is, it's powerful. Like the people that believe in conspiracy theories like this, you know, like Flat Earth is a perfect example. I mean, they're doing it for a very unconscious but specific reason. They have a need. They have to. It gives them a type of satisfaction. They feel like they're in the know.
Yeah, it really does.
It gives them almost like, you know, I don't want to over-exaggerate it, but it's kind of like that general reason to live type of thing. Like, wow, I mean, we are inside the track of this thing that nobody knows about. Nobody knows about it.
It makes them special, feel special.
Right. Yeah. That's generally true of a lot of conspiracy theories, but this one specifically, I think it's a massive, epic distrust of authority. I mean, a governmental, scientific, airline pilots, that level, you don't trust anybody in authority.
I do think it's part of the bigger phenomenon that we're seeing of the sort of the populist uprising against elitism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Because this is the ultimate anti-elitism.
Absolutely. Yep.
None of them, they're all lying to you. The scientists are lying to you. The governments are lying to you. NASA's lying to you. You can't believe those eggheads, that it's all a massive conspiracy. Even something as fundamental as the shape of the Earth, they're lying to you about that for some nefarious reason. And, you know, that's what it is. It really is an attack on expertise. It's not, I don't think it's about the flat Earth thing. That's very superficial. As Hannibal Lecter says, that's incidental.
Incidental.
Right? it's the anti-expertise, anti-intellectualism.
Yeah.
And that's what's at its core. They want to think that you can't believe the government. And if they can catch the government in a lie, then that justifies all the conspiracies.
Yeah.
It's the whole package. Well,
they're going to get it. They're getting it in truckloads right now.
But I will digress to the point that I was making earlier about the fact that the Australian government are taking action to end this quackery. And one of the interesting things was in the official statement, they listed these things like homeopathy and kinesiology, applied kinesiology, which we've been talking about downstairs earlier. And what was left off the official statement was Reiki. Mm-hmm. And that looked, and then we contacted them. I can't remember who contacted them in the organization to clarify this, and that was an oversight. Of course, Reiki's included.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. Wow, you're lucky.
The minister, when he made the statement, just made a typo or an error or something. But so.
What a wonderful country you live in.
Well, I tell you what.
Seriously.
It's got its good
Tim
points.
Tams.
Yeah. Tim Tams.
Right.
Musk sticks.
Hey.
And people that are intelligent and actually want to protect the consumers, the populace.
Yeah.
You know?
The fruit bats.
Could you imagine
fruit bats.
That they drove out of.
Out of the Botanical Gardens. That's right. Yeah.
And that's where my wife and I got engaged. So.
Right in the Opera House.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't want to hear that story again.
That was a good day.
Yeah, you'll hear it. What are you going to do about it? All right, Richard.
Anyway,
we love you. Thank you for coming.
The show's called The Skeptic Zone.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
See you.
Thank you, Richard.
See you, man.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts. 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
Yes.
We have a theme this week, and I think I've used this theme before, but I don't care. The theme is the Milky Way galaxy.
Oh, crap.
I've been there.
Oh, boy.
Been there,
Can Bob go first?
We'll see.
I agree.
We'll see. All right, here we go. Just 3 interesting facts about the Milky Way. We'll see how much you know about your own home. Ready?
Right.
Item number 1, if you viewed the Milky Way edge on, it would appear like a perfectly straight band about 10,000 light years thick with a bulge in the middle.
Item number two, the Milky Way has three rings comprised of streams of millions of stars. And item number three, the Milky Way is estimated to be 13.6 billion years old, almost as old as the universe itself at 13.7 billion years.
Oh, God, I feel like if I get any of these wrong, I'm an idiot.
Yeah,
I know, because they're all so simple sounding.
All right, Evan, right. You went last week, so I'll go first this week.
I did. So looking at the Milky Way, edge on appears like a perfectly straight band, 10,000 light years thick, and a bulge in the middle. That seems generally correct. And about 10,000 light years thick, though, it's 30,000 light years from the galactic core to the edge, the outer edge of the Milky Way galaxy. That's big. So in its thickness, that would be one third of basically, if it's radius, maybe that could work. Next one, the Milky Way has three rings comprised of streams of millions of stars. This is the one I really don't know that much about. I mean, we're a spiral galaxy, aren't we not? But these three rings must be to what? The outside, to the outer, they comprise on the outer edge of the arms of the spirals? Where are these rings? And are they really part of the galaxy? Interesting one. The last one, whereas the Milky Way is estimated to be 13.6 billion years old, almost as old as the universe itself. I thought we were a combination of galaxies that combined, because I know we're going to be combining with Andromeda at some point in the distant future. So I don't know about that one. I'm having a problem with numbers 2 and 3 the most. And I'll have to say, I've not heard of the three rings. I'm surprised, but I don't think that's a problem per se. I'm having a problem with the age of the Milky Way galaxy. I don't think it's as old as almost the universe. It'd be a proto-galaxy at 1/10 of a billion year, and it survived that long? Nah, I don't think so. I think that one's fiction.
All right, Jay?
So the first one, if you view the Milky Way on its edge, it would appear like a perfectly straight band. I mean, doesn't that matter about how far away you would be from it to see it that way, Steve? I mean,
so
I feel like
you're outside of it. That's obviously.
Yeah. So like if you were outside of it and say it seemed like an object the size of a basketball 5 feet away from you, at, you know, just as a point of perspective, and then you move your perspective to be on its edge. You know, I'm looking at it that way, you know, perfectly straight. I don't think it would be perfectly straight. Of course, yes, it has a bulge. It seems to have a bulge in the middle. I mean, interesting. Very interesting to just hear the hard fact about it and have to think of it that way. This next one about it having three rings, I don't look at them as rings. It has arms coming off the center.
Yeah, these are not the spiral arms. These are completely separate structure. They're rings.
Okay. It's hard. You know, you feel silly in a sense. You know? Don't worry about it. I'll keep moving on.
Obviously, I tried to pick obscure things about the galaxy.
Then. Right, right. Thank you for that. And this last one here is 13.6 billion years old. I mean, I hate you, Steve, because, yeah, I mean, I'm sure enough where I'm going to say I'm pretty damn sure the Milky Way is 13.6 billion years old, because that's at least a number that won't change in my lifetime. But saying that it's almost as old as the universe is itself at 13.7 billion years, you bastard. You bastard. Sweet Jesus, man. God, because I mean, I've actually heard different numbers about how old the universe is.
Yeah.
Yeah. 5,000 years old.
I mean, 13.7 billion seems like it's in a range that's acceptable to my mind. So I'm going to just say number three is correct. Now I'm swinging for number one or number two here. So does the Milky Way galaxy have rings, or does it look straight, 10,000 light years thick with a bulge in the middle? I don't think it has rings. That's the fake.
Okay, Kara.
I'm pretty sure the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And I'm pretty sure our galaxy is really old. I'm pretty sure there's material in our own solar system. No, maybe not in our solar system, but like the age of the Earth is about the age of the solar system, because that's a protoplanet. I don't know, man. I'm pretty sure that like most galaxies are almost as old as the universe. Also, I'm going to be honest. You guys are going to hate me.
Uh-huh.
Mm. I think there are three rings going around.
You simmer down. What are you doing?
I've actually interviewed stellar astronomers before. Like I interviewed a girl on my podcast who studies the Milky Way, and she told me that. But I don't know if there are millions of stars in it. What if there are billions of stars in it? That's like an order. That's like more than an order. That's three orders of magnitude off. What if there were billions? I don't know anything about millions versus billions. Those are very big numbers.
Yeah.
But I'm almost positive there are three rings. And I'm almost positive the universe is 13.7 billion years. But that doesn't mean that I'm positive that there are millions of stars or that I'm positive that it's 13.6 billion years old is our...
My God.
By God. But both of you think that the first one is science. So let's look at that one. 10,000 light years thick, bulge straight. There is a bulge in the middle. I think we can all agree with that. Is it 10,000? Is it look perfectly straight? I never see it drawn from the side. I don't know. What if it's not straight? What if it's not 10,000 light years thick? I thought that our galaxy was pretty small. But again, I have a hard time with light years, like with thousands and millions and billions. And Bob is not making any noises right now. So it's not helping me at all. But you know what? I don't want Steve to sweep us. So for strategery purposes, I'm going to say, or maybe it's wiggly. Maybe the rings make it wiggly. Yes, I think that's it. The rings make it wiggly. I'm gonna say that one's the fiction.
Oh, can I change my answer?
Okay. So Bob, yeah, they spread out all three. So no sweep for me this week. Like, what do you think?
All right, let's go through them. The number one here, the edge on view, it's a really cute way you phrase this, Steve. Very simplistic.
Yeah.
Because you know, all right. Oh, what about the gamma ray bubbles? What about the dark matter halo? What about the waves at the what about the waves in the disk caused by the tidal forces of Andromeda? Perfectly straight? No, but all right. I see what you're doing here. 10,000 light years. You know, that sounds right. I think I was thinking 10 to 15,000 light years, but 10,000 sounds right. I'd hate to be off by an order of magnitude there. So that one looks fine. Basically, that's fine. I think I know what your intention was there. The three rings. I'm not too up on these rings. It sounds right. I remember reading something about it, but number three is the one that got me here. 13.6 billion years old. The universe. Okay, that's it's kind of 13.6. Wait. Oh, the universe 13.678 is I think 7 or 8 is more accepted these days. But the Milky Way 13.6, only 100 million years after the Big Bang? No. No.
Oh, no, he's so sure of himself.
No way. And if Steve had me do the quickie with Bob, we'd all be sure of this.
No way.
100, so wait, let me think. So a tenth of a billion.
Bob, what are you doing to my 72% thing?
I'm just going with what I know here. So there's no way that the galaxy, the Milky Way is surprisingly old. I think it's what, 10, 11 billion? Is it 12 maybe? It's old, older than what I thought it was when I first found out how old the Milky Way was, much older than I thought, but it's not that old. I mean, only 100 million years. So that's gotta be false. I can't imagine. That's correct, especially based on what I know and what I had prepared for that quickie with Bob that we didn't do. So I'll say that the 13.6 billion year old Milky Way is fiction.
That
makes me feel better.
And Bob and Evan are united at the age of the galaxy. Jay thinks the rings are fiction, and Kara thinks that the edge-on view is fiction.
You don't even have to do this part, Steve. I'm just going to
go. Let's just go to the quote.
Why don't we start in the middle? The Milky Way has three rings comprised of streams of millions of stars. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Jay.
It's a black hole.
I had not heard this before.
Yeah, there's three rings. Kara's, obviously her sources were correct. There are different
good galaxy
sizes.
Scientist.
Yeah. One of them is like huge, meaning it extends way out from the plane of the galaxy. And it's basically the remnants of galaxies that the Milky Way has cannibalized over its life.
Yeah, and Evan, to answer your question, as far as I know, I think we've cannibalized plenty, but I think it's primarily like little dwarf galaxies. I'm not aware of any big merger that the Milky Way had. But hey, who knows?
There's a picture for you.
Oh, 6 billion years.
Oh, that's cool.
Look at that shit.
So
those are
just other galaxies that we sucked into ours?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's cool.
Spread out into this ring, stream.
That's got to be faint as hell, though, but that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like the rings
we're lucky some
rings around Neptune or Uranus.
Yeah.
Yeah, they must have been dwarf galaxies because I've seen, simulations of mergers with big galaxies. Whoa. And man, the streamers that you get from that it completely distorts the entire galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Beautiful.
It's also cool that they're totally out of the plane of everything else. Like, yeah. I guess I expected
Why
that they would have
they
flattened
do?
Out. I don't know. I because of the rotation, I expected that they would have flattened out over time.
But again, remember, this was another galaxy that got sucked in. So that just depends on where that galaxy was. All right, so let's go back to number one. If you viewed the Milky Way edge on, it would appear like a perfectly straight band about 10,000 light years thick with a bulge in the middle. Carrie, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. Let's talk about the structure of the Milky Way a little bit. So the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. It's
actually a barred spiral.
Yes, it's a barred spiral. B-A-R-R-E-D.
Yeah, so that means there's a bar across the middle and then the spiral arms come out.
I see. Okay.
Right? Rather than the spiral arms like sort of meeting at a point in the core, there's a bar in the middle. And there is a bulge in the middle. Of course, that's the core of the galaxy.
Yeah, we all knew that.
Yeah, there's globular clusters like a bees swarming around a hive, orbiting the the middle. I will tell you that the galaxy is about 10,000 light years thick, Edge-on, so that number is correct. Evan, you were incorrect about the 30,000 light years. That's not the distance from the core to the edge. That's the distance from the core to the Earth. It's more like double that, it's more like 120,000 light years in diameter all the way across.
And that's not including stuff like, I mean, that's just like the real visible matter, though.
Yes, exactly. It's not including the halos and the dark matter, whatever else there is. Yeah.
So the 10,000 light years thick is not the bulgy part. It's like the arms.
That's the spiral arms. Correct.
Okay.
So the only detail that we haven't touched on is it perfectly straight when seen edge on?
Yes.
And the answer is it is not straight. This one is the fiction.
What the?
This one is the fiction. Good job, Kara.
Kara.
Yay, I got it for all the wrong reasons.
It is warped. The galaxy looked edge on is warped. It's like twisted.
No way.
So if you took the galaxy.
Is that because of the tidal forces with Andromeda?
Not Andromeda. The Maginella clouds. So that there's two dwarf galaxies that are closely orbiting the Milky Way, the Magellanic clouds, and they will pull on the gas clouds in the Milky Way, which affects the star formation. And over, the billions of years, this has warped the Milky Way so that if you took what you typically think of as the Milky Way as edged on and you just twist it, like you're twisting up a towel or something, right? So that it's.
Do you have a picture of that?
Yes, I do.
Yay.
Not of the Milky Way, but there's a picture of another warped galaxy that it gives you an indication of what the Milky Way probably looks like.
Oh, it's twisted like your radius and ulna are twisted.
Yeah.
So that's never seen that.
That's an actual galaxy, not the Milky Way, but that's what the Milky Way would look like, Edge.
That's cool.
Yep, thanks to Hubble. Hubble got you. The spiral galaxy ESO 510-13.
That's a fluke for sure.
Now, which means that the Milky Way is estimated to be 13.6 billion years old, almost as old as the universe itself at 13.7 billion years is science.
Old.
And yeah, it's older than I thought
man.
It was, too.
I don't know about that.
The sun went through a couple of rebirths, but I didn't think that.
Our sun's 4.5 whatever billion years old.
I'm seeing Milky Way 13.4, which is still older than I thought, but a couple hundred million years.
So that's based
what is your source?
That's based upon
universe today.
That's my source too, but that's based upon the age of the oldest star detected in the Milky Way galaxy. So
which are
in globular clusters. So there are stars in globular clusters that we've aged at 13.6 billion years old. In fact, for a time.
Wow.
there were stars in the Milky Way that were older than our estimate for the age of the universe, and that was a problem.
Oh, but, remember that?
Yeah,
that
was we thought, okay, well, probably the universe is a little bit older than we thought, and that's what it turned out to be. So, yeah, the revised estimate of the age of the universe is 13.7 billion years, but the age of the Milky Way, it remains at almost at the same time, you know, about 13.6. So, yeah, about 100 million years after the Big Bang, galaxies were forming.
I don't know, Steve.
Our Milky Way was forming right at that time. It's obviously evolved a lot over that time. It's absorbed a lot of
a tremendous amount. I mean, we detected you. That quickie that I was going to do was about a galaxy, Steve. That was
500 million.
13 billion light years. Let's see. It was 500 million light years. 500 million years after the Big Bang, which makes it older. I mean, younger than the Milky Way.
Yeah, but Bob, this is the oldest galaxy we can see in detail, right? Not the oldest galaxy that exists.
No, but they think that this galaxy is among – the article said it's among the oldest galaxies.
So is the Milky Way.
So is – Steve, I've been
– I did not think it was that old.
I didn't think so.
That's why I
just went to the Milky Way's wiki page, and it says – I'm clicking through – what is GYA? Do you guys know what that is? That
giga years ago? Billions of years ago.
So billions. Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah. There's a star called the Methuselah star.
Yeah.
HD 140283. And it actually says that its age is 14.46 plus or minus 0.8.
That's a good trick.
Yeah, that minus 0.8 is the key.
Yeah.
Right?
So it says minimum of 13.66. 190 light years away from the Earth in the constellation Libra.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's why, but there's a plus or minus. So it's estimated to be about 13.6, where the universe is about 13.7. And that's.
This is bananas.
Sourced from Universe Today. So that's, I think that's a reasonable.
Oh, happy birthday. Source.
Yeah, that was tricky. That was tricky, Bob. I hear
wow,
you.
Man. My very cockiness tricky. Was not warranted this time. Damn it. Good job,
hey, Bob.
Kara.
Bob,
good job.
Keep
it
up, though, Bob. Go before me. I always GWB on any, like, that was fluky.
Oh, my God.
Though.
I would have bet 10 skulls on this. I would have bet 10 of my skulls.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that was, like, because Steve knew that you had bet. I bet you he wrote these for you.
Well, I should have known. I should have known the age of the Milky Way.
I knew they had to be
that.
Challenging enough for Bob. The thing is, though, I thought you might have known about the galaxy being warped. Because I knew about that, but
that level of warp—the only warp that I'm familiar with was the tidal, the little waves at the edges of the galaxy caused by the tidal forces.
No, because I've read
that significant type of warping that you showed me the picture of. I was like, damn,
I've read that
before. Level.
But yeah, it's cool. Yeah, you know, I'm very interested in galaxies ever since high school. You know, I actually wrote a computer program in high school to simulate spiral galaxies. But that was kind of like my focus in my astronomy class as a high school senior, and fascinated with galactic structure and all that stuff. So I like to continually update my mental image of what the Milky Way galaxy looks like. And so I remember that, like, oh shit, the thing is twisted. It's not even straight on the edge. So every picture I've ever seen of the Milky Way galaxy is wrong. Basically,
and don't forget to add those gamma ray bubbles, man.
Yeah,
they're awesome.
I know.
Yeah, but remember, his clue was if you looked at it, which means visible.
Yes, right. But yeah, it was perfectly straight. I thought that I was trying to be fair there. I thought you guys would balk at the perfectly straight thing. But the thing is, and something massive and astronomical could be at that scale to our vision could look perfectly straight.
I agree.
And we're used to looking at pictures of spiral galaxies edge on that do look perfectly straight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just that ours is a rare twisted or warped spiral galaxy because we have these close satellite dwarf galaxies, and not every spiral
and
galaxy has that.
And Steve, a lot of the images I've seen in the Milky Way in different wavelengths, I don't remember any major bends either.
Yeah, but you can't really see that. You can't see that. You know, so you can never really image you can't say enough of the Milky Way from our perspective.
Right, because we're inside it. Right.
Yeah, so it's always looking at other galaxies and drawing an analogy or drawing a picture of what it would look like from outside. But you've never actually seen the Milky Way from outside, obviously.
No, but it is cool how close to outside of it. I mean, we're still in it, but we can see a lot of it from where we are, which is neat.
Well,
like, if we were closer to the middle, it would be...
Yeah, that's true.
Those images would look a lot different.
Okay, good job, Kara. Evan, give us a quote.
Borderlines between genuine science and pseudoscience may be fuzzy, but this should be even more of a call for careful distinctions based on systematic facts and sound reasoning. To try a modicum of turtle blood here and there and a little aspirin here and there is not the hallmark of wisdom and even-mindedness. It's a dangerous gateway to superstition and irrationality. And that was written by Massimo Pellucci and Martin Baudry, if I mispronounce that, from an article they wrote, which appeared in the New York Times in 2013, called The Dangers of Pseudoscience.
Turtle blood, he says.
That quote has Massimo written all over it.
Is he talking about traditional Chinese medicine?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is all about the demarcation problem, right? It's hard to tell. Yeah. There's no sharp line between science and pseudoscience. That's why all the more reason why we need to be more careful. And just mixing snake oil or turtle blood with, you know, medicine like aspirin doesn't really get you very far. It's not the hallmark of wisdom. You need to be able to distinguish between these two things. I like the quote. Very good.
I'd be remiss if I didn't say this on air because I promised someone I would.
Go ahead.
We need to protect the pangolins.
Pangolins are adorable. Have you ever seen them climbing a tree?
Pangolins are amazing. No, I've never seen one climbing a tree. They're amazing, but they are being destroyed, slaughtered for traditional Chinese medicine. And that's what made me think of it when you said turtle blood. It's no different than pangolin scales. It's just one of these things where it's a massive environmental problem.
Wow. That's terrible.
Let's keep our eyes peeled, read about the pangolins, understand their plight. Sorry.
And if you don't know what a pangolin is, look it up. They're adorable.
They're amazing.
They're weird, too. I mean, it's a very different kind of animal you're not used to looking at. And when, like, the first time you see one, if you've never seen one before, you're like, what the hell is that?
What the hell is that? Let's chop it up and make medicine out of it.
Where does that fit into the kingdom of life? Like, you have no idea.
Exactly. And if you've never seen one before and you're just now discovering this amazing species, it's going to be that much more sad to know that they're already really threatened. So, read about them. Learn about them. They're amazing.
People. Human beings.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining me tonight for this doubleheader that we had to record all in one night.
Right. Hey, enjoy the rest of your weekend in Hawaii and you, Kara, in the Netherlands.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.